The Guardian.
What are you going to do when this podcast is over? From the most trivial to the most serious, decisions are central to our lives. But how the brain makes up its mind about what to do remains one of neuroscientists' greatest mysteries. Step Forward, the International Brain Laboratory. It's a new, ambitious project that will combine expertise from 21 labs across the globe with the express aim of bringing us closer to understanding what goes on in the brain when we make decisions. But how does the IBL hope to achieve this ambitious goal? What new technologies will the scientists use? And what can new insights into decision-making tell us about our brains?
It's a really open question whether the kinds of computations that support decision-making at a fast time scale will be similar to the ones that support decision-making at a longer time scale. And along the same lines, whether their computations are the same is an open question, and also how those processes are implemented is an open question.
Up until recently, we could only see like one area at a time. In fact, most of the time, we could only see one neuron at a time out of a sea of 70 billion neurons. But the tools have changed, especially in rodents, and that's actually one of the things we want to do, is we want to take advantage of the tools to look at the entire brain at once while the animal is performing the task.
Yeah, shall I ask? Yeah, Anne.
I'm Ian Sample. This is Science Weekly.
It does sound really good to me, actually, better than before.
Okay.
Yeah.
A troubleshooter, do you think?
Okay.
To help me unpick decision-making and the approach being taken by the International Brain Laboratory, I spoke to two of the scientists leading the charge.
Anne Churchland, Associate Professor at Cold Spring Harbor Laboratory.
And down the line, Alex Puget.
I'm a computational neuroscientist at the University of Geneva in the Basic Neuroscience Department.
I started by asking them both why decision-making is such an appealing target.
We want to study decision-making because as humans, we make decisions all the time, and the decisions that we make really define the course of our lives. And decisions can be very complex, but also simple enough that we can study them easily in animals.
So, I mean, let me just add, actually follow up on this. There is also another aspect of decision making that we find really interesting, that it's one of the central tasks that the brain actually performs. And so what we're hoping is that it's also going to shed light on the general mechanism by which the brain computes. So we want to understand basic computational properties of neural circuits. Because if we understand that, then we'll be able to understand how the brain performs other tasks besides decision-making. A bit like if you understand how a CPU works in a computer, you can figure out how it does word processing, but also how it does video games and everything else that you can do with the computer.
We're constantly making decisions, from these small, mundane ones that we barely give a thought to these major ones we mull over for weeks and months. I'm wondering whether neuroscientists have to break down decision-making into different varieties. And if they do, what these sort of varieties are?
Yeah, as you say, decisions take place on lots of different timescales. Some decisions we make super fast, like when you're at a stoplight and you're deciding whether to stop or go, and you make that decision based on the color of the light. That's really a split-second decision. We make it very quickly. It takes almost no time at all to get the relevant information to do the right thing. There are other decisions, as you say, that operate on much longer timescales. When you're deciding which car to buy, it might take you many months, and you might put together lots of different kinds of information. You might look on the internet to get information. You might go and sit in the car and see how it smells and how it feels. Those decisions take place over a very long timescale. It's a really open question whether the kinds of computations that support decision-making at a fast time scale will be similar to the ones that support decision-making at a longer time scale. And along the same lines, whether their computations are the same is an open question, and also how those processes are implemented is an open question. Probably the mechanisms that support these very fast decisions are quite different from the ones that support the very long decisions. And we want to ultimately understand both slow and fast decisions.
Alex, do there seem to be common steps in the process for different types of decision making, such as evidence gathering, risk benefit assessments, and so on?
Yeah, those components are common to all decisions. And one thing that's actually also quite incredible is that we have currently some mathematical models that allows us to understand how we make, in particular, the very fast decision that Anne was talking about, like determining the color of the light at a traffic light. And the models that we use, those models work just as well in animals like mice as they do in humans when we consider the same task. So they're very common mechanisms across species that makes us think that if we study animals, we can actually deduce a lot about how humans also perform those decisions.
And can you tell us what parts of the brain tend to be involved, or is it really across the whole organ?
As far as we can tell, it's distributed across the brain. I mean, clearly there are some areas that seem to play a more central role, in particular the frontal part of your brain, which is the one that really vastly increased in humans compared to other animals. That part is involved, possibly also another part that has to do with visual attention, selecting the right type of information and selecting the right action, and that area is called the parietal cortex. So those are major players, but we know that a huge chunk of the brain activates every time we make decisions, and we don't really understand how the brain coordinates the activity of all those different areas to actually extract a response to a stimulus.
So first of all, I'm in complete agreement that it's clear that there are many, many areas in the brain that are involved when we make decisions. And that's partly what's been kind of a challenge for the field, is that individual labs usually measure neural activity from one or maybe a couple of areas. And so that kind of whole brain picture is really missing. And because decisions are complex and involve many different kinds of computations, estimating rewards, accumulating evidence, and so on, it's clear that many structures are involved, but our understanding of how and when they work together is at a pretty early stage.
As Anne says, different labs have different approaches, and that makes studying this complex field even more of a challenge. It's something the International Brain Laboratory hopes to address with mouse studies. But before we come on to the actual project, I wanted to know how I should think about the decision-making process itself. In my mind, I'm picturing it very simplistically, which is a bunch of neurons in part of my brain fire, and then that information goes to another part of my brain and the neurons there fire. But is there parallel processing? Is a lot of different things going on at different times, which are then maybe brought to one point where a decision can be said to be made? I have no idea how to really envisage this.
Yeah, I think one's first instinct is to think about the process in the way that you described as being kind of first one area and then a next. You might imagine if you're making the decision about whether to stop or go that I mentioned earlier, that first visual cortex will be activated and then an association area and then the motor cortex. And that's sort of the way we sometimes talk about it when we're talking to students who are just learning about this for the first time. But I think in reality, it's probably a lot more complicated than that. There are probably many more areas involved, and the signals go both forwards and backwards. So the signals might come into the brain, into a sensory area, up to a frontal area that Alex mentioned a moment ago, and then maybe go back and modify those incoming sensory areas so that the right signals are pulled out and so on. And so I think probably there's a lot more feedback and loops than one would imagine if one considered the simple serial model.
Yeah, and if I may add to this, one of the reasons also it's we don't know that much about how the whole brain contributes to this and whether the serial model that you describe is correct or whether a more complex one like the one Anne was talking about is correct, is that we didn't have the tool to look at the whole brain. Up until recently, we could only see like one area at a time. In fact, most of the time, we could only see one neuron at a time out of a sea of 70 billion neurons. But the tools have changed, especially in rodents, and that's actually one of the things we want to do is we want to take advantage of the tools to look at the entire brain at once while the animal is performing the task. And we expect that this is going to deliver a very novel and unexpected picture and model for how this is done by the brain.
Alex, the Wellcome Trust and the Simons Foundation have recently put up funds to launch this international brain laboratory that you're involved with. Can you tell us about that and how it will differ from some of these other collaborative brain projects that have been cropping up?
Yes, absolutely. This is the IBL, or International Brain Lab, is a new model for trying to perform neuroscience within large-scale collaboration. So this is an idea that's very much inspired by physics, where physicists have realized that for some of the really difficult challenges that they face, no single lab can actually crack the problem on their own. They need to collaborate. But not just collaborate in some kind of nebulous network, they have to coordinate the efforts in a very precise manner, and they have to all focus on exactly the same problem. And the International Brain Lab is really an attempt at bringing this model in neuroscience. It's going to be a group of, at the beginning, 21 labs spread across the world that are going to focus on exactly the same task with standardized tools. And by having exactly the same task, then it means that we'll be able to collect the data and to integrate the data into kind of a grand theory of decision-making in animals. And that aspect has not been tried yet in neuroscience, so this is going to be really the first time we tried this. And we're very, very grateful to the Wellcome Trust and the Simons Foundation for really giving us the opportunity to try it.
And you're also involved in the IBL. Can you take us through some of these problems that can be caused by different groups of neuroscientists essentially working towards the same issue, but they can use slightly different methods, slightly different analyses, and so on?
Yeah, the way that the field works right now is exactly as you say. There are individual labs that are measuring activity from just a couple of areas. And it might seem that one could simply pool data from across many different labs who are working on different areas and get kind of a brain-wide picture. But the reason why that's not possible at the moment is that right now many labs sort of operate quite independently. And so I run a decision-making lab, but a colleague of mine who runs a decision-making lab at another university might just do things slightly different in a way that makes it really quite challenging to pool the data from our labs to get a brain-wide picture of what's going on. And part of what's driving this is that there isn't much standardization of the kinds of behaviors that are studied, the way that the data is collected, the way that the data is analyzed. And that's one of the obstacles that we hope to surmount in our collaboration, is to have standardization of behavior, of neural measurement, of analysis, pre-processing, and at every stage to have things be the same across our team so that we can pool all the data together and get a much bigger picture about what's going on.
An ambitious project, to say the least. And after this short break, we hear exactly how they hope to use mice to reach their grand theory.
And so we're seeking to recreate the essence of those foraging decisions within a laboratory environment.
And so we're hoping that understanding decision-making in animals will be a step towards making progress toward understanding those other problems.
We'll be right back. Before we kick off again, I wanted to point you in the direction of another podcast here at The Guardian. It's called Brexit Means, and as the name would suggest, attempts to finally find out what exactly Brexit does mean, apart from, of course, Brexit. So if you feel like delving into the nitty-gritty of Britain's exit from the EU, make sure to join John Henley and his experts on The Guardian's Brexit Means. To find out more, head over to theguardian.com/podcasts or search Brexit Means on your favourite podcast app. Welcome back to Science Weekly. I'm Ian Sample. Before the break, we heard from computational neuroscientist Alex Puget about the incredible complexity of the neural pathways that underlie the everyday phenomenon of decision-making. Historically, this has been very difficult to study in a collaborative way across different labs. As neuroscientist Dan Churchland told us, it's one of the reasons why the International Brain Laboratory was set up. By standardizing the approach in labs around the world, the hope is that scientists can use rodent models to come up with a grand theory of decision-making.
All they have to agree with is that it's good enough to try.
But exactly how are they going to do this? Here's Anne again.
The goal of the behavior that we're hoping to study in the IBL is that we want to study decisions that are of the sort that the animal makes when it's in a true natural foraging environment. So if you think about what that means, what does it mean for a mouse or any animal to go out and forage for food? Well, there's a lot of decisions that you have to make. So an animal's navigating through some kind of an environment. Maybe there's some sensory information at the head that's indicating there could be food available there. In addition, the animal has some internal knowledge of which parts of the environment tend to be more rewarding. Like, oh, I remember last time I went off to the left here, there were lots of crickets there for me to eat. And so what really defines those foraging decisions is that animals combine sensory signals, like what they see and what they smell, with an internal representation of how rewarding different options are. And so we are seeking to recreate the essence of those foraging decisions within a laboratory environment. So we have bring the animals into the lab, and we study them in a situation where they're given visual signals that are informative about which of two movements will be rewarded. So animals, they're rewarded with juice or water, and they can make different actions to harvest a reward. And what determines the reward that they will get is both the incoming sensory signal that we present to them on a computer screen, and that's meant to replicate the kind of sensory signals about food that they would encounter in the real world, and also their internal knowledge of which actions tend to be the most rewarding. And so by having both of those features, the reward, the dynamic reward structure, and an incoming sensory signal, the mouse can make good decisions that we hope are informative about foraging decisions generally.
Anne, how will you know what's going on in the animal brain?
Yeah, that's a key part of the collaboration and one that I'm really excited about. We have three different ways of measuring neural activity. The first one is that we measure electrical signals in the brain. Neurons in the cells in the brain communicate with each other through electrical signals called action potentials, and we can measure these with electrodes that we place in the brain. People have been using this technique for quite a while, but we're in a position now that we can measure the neural activity from many more neurons than people have previously recorded. This ability to measure lots of neurons at the same time is also supported by the second method that we're using to measure neural activity, which is two-photon microscopy. And this is a method by which we can image neurons, sort of like taking very, very fast pictures of them one after another. And by looking at their brightness, which is sort of a proxy for how active they are, we can get a sense of what a whole population of neurons is doing over time as an animal's making a decision. We have a third way of monitoring neural activity, and that's called fiber photometry. And that's a method that we can use to monitor the activity of neuromodulators like dopamine, which you've probably heard about. It's a neuromodulator that's very helpful for animals in the way that they interpret rewards and use those rewards to update their behaviors. So having those three methods together gives us three different ways of looking at neural activity. They each kind of have trade-offs. And I think the thing that's linking them, and that's partly what's so exciting about this collaboration, is that we can use them to measure lots of neurons at the same time and come up with really interesting analyses to understand what those population level recordings are telling us about the computations that support decision making.
Alex, give us an idea of what the theoreticians will be doing while all these experiments are going on.
Well, as you heard from Anne, we're going to have a very rich data set with different kind of measurements, thousands of cells. And so from this, we're going to have to reconstruct the puzzle. How does the entire brain actually solve the decision-making task? And to be perfectly honest, at this point in time, nobody has even suggested a whole brain theory of decision-making. So this is where the theoreticians really need to start thinking globally about how the entire system functions. And I expect that this is going to be a back and forth between the data and the theoretician over the next 3 to 5 years that's going to allow us to really come up with the first hypothesis for the theory.
It's incredible to think that within 5 or so years, the project might come up with the first whole brain hypothesis of how decisions, albeit very simple ones, are made. Before they get there, though, what can we expect from the International Brain Laboratory?
One of the first things that we will produce is kind of a big picture of what the brain is doing during decision making. And that first deliverable, if you will be really kind of descriptive. It'll say, okay, here are neurons all across the brain. This is just what they do during decision making. And so I think that's the first thing that we hope to create as a collaboration. And I'm definitely really excited to have that. I think the really interesting science will come from when we take that data and start to analyze it, to see what's there, to find ways of summarizing and visualizing the activity, and then from those analyses to make new theories of decision making based on the brain-wide interactions that we observe.
Alex, do you think these kinds of results could provide the foundations for understanding more complex decisions, the kinds of decisions that involve people buying houses, marrying people, buying cars, things like that?
Yes, certainly that's a prerequisite for thinking about the more complex decision. understanding how you take the evidence that's immediately available to guide your decisions and how this eventually leads to the selection of the appropriate action that takes into account the cost and benefits of the different options. That's key, and that's what we're going to be studying at IBL. We're still going to be missing some really important components of the more complex decision. In particular, how does your decision-making abilities interact with your memory system? You know, when you're trying to decide about your life partner, for instance, you have to start thinking about all the things that you've lived with this person, the good and the bad events that you have lived together, and you have to reaccess that in your memory and from that try to come up with a decision. That process of the interaction of decision-making and memory is poorly understood. There's a lot of work going on already, but there are huge gaps in our knowledge right now.
There's another area which is ethically interesting, shall we say, that your work may impinge on, and that's presumably intelligence. That from this work, I'm wondering whether you might be able to glean some idea of what makes one brain more intelligent than another, if you define intelligence as the ability to make the right decision at the right time.
It will be really interesting to take advantage of the fact that animals have a lot of variability in the rate at which they learn behaviors, the sorts of strategies that they exhibit both during learning of a behavior and once they've mastered a behavior. And I think it will be fascinating to compare the neural activity across animals that are really very different. Some of them learn quickly, some of them take more time, some of them use sort of superstitious strategies like repeating the same choice or switching every choice, even though that's not going to help them getting any kind of reward. And so I think comparing these individual differences and understanding how differences in neural activity are driving the differences will be really fascinating. My hypothesis is that it's going to give us a much richer view of intelligence than we currently have. I think at the moment we tend to think of intelligence as being kind of one-dimensional, and we think of success in particular kinds of behaviors as being indicative of intelligence or no intelligence. I think my experience in observing animals so far is that there are lots of different ways that animals figure out to solve the tasks, and there are sometimes kind of funny things that can either help or hurt an animal. There are highly variable trajectories that animals undergo when they're learning a complex behavior, and it will be fascinating to see the different kinds of patterns of neural activity that might underlie those individual strategies.
Yeah, I just want to say when it comes to intelligence, I think we have to be a little bit modest, though, about what we can accomplish with IBL, because while Anne is perfectly right, we're going to start having a first look at what differentiate a smart mouse from a not-so-smart ones. Nonetheless, one has to keep in mind that when we're talking about intelligence in rodents, it has little to do with intelligence in humans. Humans have an ability to build models of the world around them. There are extremely complex models. That's actually what we do in science. We really come up with mathematical models of the physical world in a way that, of course, no rodents can approach. So while we're going to start looking at intelligence in rodents, I think there will be a very, very long way to go before we get to humans, keeping in mind, for instance, that human brain has 1,000 times more neurons than a rodent brain. So obviously here there will be a gigantic gap to fill in the future.
So whilst we might not be lifting the veil on human intelligence anytime soon, the IBL approach could lead to some huge breakthroughs.
Well, clearly it would be a major achievement for the field. As we mentioned earlier, decisions are really at the heart of your life. We make decisions all the time. This is what the brain is about. And understanding how we make those decisions can have all sorts of implications for other fields, whether it's, of course, people who suffer from psychiatric disorders. We need to understand how we make decisions before we can understand how it fails. In the field of artificial intelligence, we're hoping that understanding how humans make decisions will inform how we can program or teach computers to actually make those decisions. A third field would be also what we call neuroeconomics, understanding how we make financial decisions, whether it's just buying something in the supermarket or investing your assets in the stock markets. Those are essential questions for society at large. And so we're hoping that understanding decision-making in animals will be a step toward making progress toward understanding those other problems.
Yeah, I agree with Alex. I think to add one point, I think we also hope that the kinds of insights that we generate through this collaboration will turn out to be relevant for our understanding of human disease. It's reasonable to think of a lot of cognitive problems as being really deficits in decision making. For example, one way to describe somebody who's very impulsive is to say, well, they really know what the right thing is to do, but they can't do the right thing. And another way to think about addiction is that there are different stimuli that are being kind of misweighted, right? The decision is either to go to work or to go to the bar. Well, you know, we know that going to the work is the right thing to do, but when you're in an addicted state, then by definition, you tend to overweight the opportunity of going to get the substance that you're addicted to. And so right now, a lot of those disorders were really at an early stage of being able to treat them well, I think addiction especially. And we really do hope that by understanding decision making better, that we'll be able to start to offer insights that will be relevant to coming up with really good treatments for those disorders.
So, what are you going to do at the end of this podcast? It's time to decide. Special thanks this week to Anne Churchland and Alex Puget. If you want to find out more about the IBL project, we'll include a link to a recent article I wrote in the episode's description on The Guardian's website. If you've got any questions, queries or feedback, please get in touch via our email address, scienceweekly@theguardian.com. I'm Ian Sample. This is Science Weekly.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.